In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
We go spotlighting for endangered species as scientists race to bring the black-footed ferret toward recovery. From SDPB, this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we head into the field with black-footed ferret biologists. The species was thought to have disappeared from the earth. Then a Wyoming dog named Shep brought home a black-footed ferret who had been nibbling from his dog dish. The scramble to find black-footed ferrets in the wild lurched into overdrive. Now, from mid-August to early November, biologists search for new kits to protect from plague. We head to the Kanata Basin this hour, travel along as we catch, release, and listen to the most endangered mammal we have as they scamper and even hiss to survive. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first.
Even though I can see through the window, it feels a bit more intimate when I have the window open and I can feel the breeze and smell it and just see, even there's a ferret right there.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The voice you just heard is Travis Laveri. He is Executive Director of Prairie Wildlife Research. He studies the most endangered mammal in North America, the black-footed ferret.
I'm sure this is our mom and her two kits. She just went down real quick, but I just caught a glimpse of her eye shine, and she'll hopefully pop back up here.
Now, there are fewer than 500 individual black-footed ferrets left in the world. Over half of the entire population is right here in the Kanata Basin in Badlands National Park.
See, there she is.
I see her.
Laveri and other field biologists head out into the basin at 10 p.m. local time and spotlight for ferrets until sunrise. He drives a white pickup truck loaded with ferret traps. Mounted to the ceiling of the truck is a high-powered spotlight on a swivel. He is scanning the ground all the way to the left, sweeping across in front of our headlights all the way to the right, then back again, hour after hour, looking for two flashes of emerald green on the prairie. The reflection of two tiny eyes peering out over the rim of an earthen burrow.
Take the binoculars. Creep up on her a little bit here.
SDPB came along for an all-night ride-along. I sat in the front seat. Producer Ellen Kester sat in the back.
Do you put yourself in kind of the ferret's mindset a lot?
Steve and I have great spirited arguments and discussions, usually that involves beer, about what ferrets think and do and why they do it. Sometimes it happens at 8 o'clock in the morning when we're done and whatnot, and that's our breakfast beer. And oh, again, they're weasels, and they're mostly fearless weasels. There she is, popping her head up a little bit.
This hour, we will bring you conversations with Laveri and field biologist Steve Forrest, and we'll invite you into Laveri's truck to experience the modern-day scientific magic of seeing a black-footed ferret in the wild.
Okay, we'll leave her be.
Before we turn on that spotlight and bring the first ferret into the truck, let's take a step back. Let's head inside Travis Laveri's research trailer. It's parked within acres of prairie dog habitat. Inside the trailer is part wildlife lab and, frankly, part plumbing shop. pay attention to what Laveri says here about his blue dye marker. It looks like a regular dry erase marker with a blue tip, but it is safe to use on wild animals. We're going to be marking more than one black-footed ferret tonight.
So when we capture a black-footed ferret in a trap, those are ferret traps, and we'll hopefully be using lots of those tonight. We'll put it into a tube like this. This is a drain tile, 4-inch drain tile tubing with two little wooden doors on the ends so that we can then contain the ferret within this without having to alarm it too much. Then we can transport it pretty easily back to this trailer, where then I'm going to hook it up to this homemade PVC pipe anesthesia chamber with a sewer gate valve on it. And then I'm going to open up the doors like this. And I'm going to take my magic ferret plunger. Stick in and push the ferret into the chamber.
What is that? That is made. That is duct tape.
Door. A paper towel roll on top of a broom handle with duct tape on it.
So you made all this.
Pretty much everything you see is homemade
this
here.
Is a MacGyver.
We don't go to the hardware store and buy a lot of things that are just off the shelf. So then once I've got the ferret in the chamber, then I can turn. This is oxygen tank, and this is a isoflurane vaporizer. So it's a gas anesthesia, similar to what a veterinarian would use on your dog or cat. After a few minutes, the ferret becomes anesthetized, analgesic, and floppy. Put him on the mask. Then as long as he's breathing this combination of oxygen and 3% or 2% isoflurane gas, he remains anesthetized. Then I can do all the fun stuff here. I can put the microchip in. Here's the microchip needle. You can see how big that is. It's like a size of a grain of rice.
How many ferrets have you chipped out here per year?
Per year?
Per season.
So this year, we just got started this year, but we've chipped... Last year we did, I think, 150 kits through this last year. So 150, probably 160 ferrets came through the trailer here last year.
Wow. Yeah. Are you tracking them off the chip? What all does the chip do?
That microchip can only be read by a reader within a few inches of it. So we've got these specialized readers that can then read that chip. So after the ferret is done, I will then... procedure happens mostly here on this pad. They will move on to the scale there, and then I will put them into the carrier there to actually recover. And within about maybe 10 minutes after the anesthesia is done, they're fully awake and ready to go. So it's designed to be a quick, simple process to get them out as fast as we can. You want to minimize the amount of time that you're handling the animal, minimize the amount of anesthesia, minimize the stress. These are wild animals that have never seen human beings before. This is alien abduction. Big light at night comes and finds you at night and grabs you and knocks you out and pokes you and prods you, and you wake up an hour later right back where you were.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Wow. So what all, are you drawing blood from them? What are you looking for?
Not this week, but sometimes. Okay. So typically my routine when I've got a black-footed ferret out on the table here is I will then be scanning them. I will comb them for ticks and fleas and take some samples of that. I will take a hair sample and store it in an envelope. That can be used for genetics, that can be used for diet analysis, things like that. Then I will scan them for a microchip, make sure that they're not chipped, put a microchip into them, glue that hole shut with this VetBond 3M glue. Then I will give them vaccines for plague and distemper. Then I will measure them, and I also determine their sex and age using some fur discolorations and then their teeth as well. And then I will take a cheek cell sample, which can also be used for DNA. I put a dye mark on their neck. I use these fancy blue dye markers designed for lab animals. Blue is just the most unnatural color on a black-footed ferret. So if the next night, if I see even a hint of blue on their neck, I know I've already captured them. I don't need to go and put a trap on them. I can leave them alone. So it's one of those visual things we can help to figure out, you know, oh, that one does not have blue in the neck. I haven't captured that one yet. And now I know I need to get that one.
Okay. You know?
Right. And then they get weighed, and then they go in the box. So sometimes I will draw blood for some different purposes. If we're looking at vaccines and things like that, or we're looking for diseases. But this week we have not been doing any blood work. Yeah.
So you mentioned DNA and genetics a couple times. These are all descended from you told me last time, the original remaining 18 ferrets that were rescued by some pretty bold scientists who were trying to race against the clock. Tell us a little bit about that story so we can understand why that genetics is important right now.
Sure. So every black-footed ferret alive today is descended from 18 individuals, all from one population from Meteetse, Wyoming. So those 18 individuals we know were mother-daughter related already. So it's basically like taking a small family group and saying that's everything comes from this family group from now on. And so we know that our genetics are pretty limited to begin with. We haven't seen any major complications from that yet. We do see some bad teeth, some kinked tails, some short ears, things like that. One of the founding ferrets, they think, had only one kidney, and that's come through a few times in some of them. But so far, so good. We're not as bad as cheetahs, where like a cheetah, you can take a skin graft from one and put it on another, and it'll accept it. That's how, you know, genetically depauperate cheetahs are. We're not that bad. But we need to think about genetic diversity and preserving what we have from those original 18. So the captive breeding is done very carefully. They manage that to maximize genetic diversity in captivity. On top of that, more recently now, they've actually cloned a black-footed ferret from the Meteetse population that was no longer part of the genetic representation today. So we're figuring out ways how to gently, slowly, you know, incrementally increase genetic diversity. But there's also these new great tools on the horizon, CRISPR-Cas9 and these genetic editing tools. We could probably look back at, say, what did the genome of a black-footed ferret that lived here in, say, 1925 look like? And then we could possibly go in and edit that genome a little bit for a current ferret to make it look like one of those older ferrets.
So out here, there's no breeding. This is a wild population that's self-sustaining right now. And that's a success story.
Yes. So we reintroduced about 300 captive-born black-footed ferrets here between 1994 and 99. And that population has been self-sustaining since then. We have not needed any additional captive ferrets for reintroduction. And we are the only site, unfortunately, that is that way right now.
Still the ferret capital of the world?
Still is the ferret capital of the world. Yep. And I'm really hoping that other sites will compete with us for that at some point in time.
We walk outside the research trailer and onto a low, flat landscape illuminated by an almost full moon. Field biologist Steve Forrest is also spotlighting in his own truck tonight. Forrest and Laveri are working biologists, but also living archives of ferret history. Forrest was on the ground level in Meteetse, Wyoming, when scientists were wrestling with how to bring the species from the brink of extinction. Forrest helped write the Black-Footed Ferret Recovery Plan. In other words, if not for Steve Forrest and his colleagues, we wouldn't be looking for black-footed ferrets tonight. There wouldn't be any. And here's something else to listen for in this segment. Nothing. It was so quiet. And still, in the Kanata Basin, it sounded like we were in a recording studio.
You have quite a history with the black-footed ferret.
Well, I don't know. I'm trying to think. 40, 50 years? It's a little ridiculous. I was a young graduate student at the time the ferrets were rediscovered at Meteetse, and was a Wyoming native, so I was able to get my foot in the door there. And been off and on since that time. So that was the early 90s.
Tell us this story again for people who don't know. There's Shep the dog, and there's a ferret eating his dog food.
Like, how did we find out these were not extinct animals, and how rare is that experience?
Well, they had been thought to be extinct. The last ones that were known had died in captivity in the back east. There'd been an attempt to try to catch a few and breed them. They hadn't been seen in the wild for quite a while, and there were several reward programs offered to folks in the West to report any sightings of ferrets. So it happened that this dog that belonged to John and Lucille Hogg killed this ferret that was trying to eat out of its dog dish. Very famous story. Shep was a wonderful dog, by the way. And then an effort, you know, shortly thereafter was underway to find where these ferrets came from that the dog killed. And I was involved very early on with those studies. We didn't know very much about ferrets, where they lived, how many were there, was this a population that could be perhaps taken into captivity. That was all brand new. There was a lot of distrust about captive breeding. So a lot of very early kind of lessons learned there with that population was great.
Yeah, what were the pressures and?
Well, there was a lot of.
What are you racing against too?
Well, we didn't know how many there were, and at that time there was a fellow. I had just come from a graduate program at Yale, and one of the professors there taught a course called Island Biogeography, and this was a very new concept, but it was basically the study of what happens when you get very smaller and smaller islands of animals, and why don't we have large populations of animals on islands. And so there was a lot of thinking that went into, you know, how small can something get before they can't persist, and how long can we expect these populations to persist? So that was one of the first questions we asked the Metizi, was how big is this population? Is this thing likely to crank along on its own for a while? And our conclusion was pretty quickly that it was really small and really subject to a lot of random forces that could probably wipe it out at any time. And in fact, that's what happened a couple of years later, unfortunately. But so right away, the captive breeding part of it was, though, very controversial at the time, because there was a lot of thinking with some biologists that we ought to just leave things alone, and they'll kind of repair on their own, and that we didn't know enough to intervene. That was kind of a lot of hubris involved in that. And so that was kind of the big conflict early on, but we got over that hump, and now, of course, a very successful captive breeding program that the Fish and Wildlife Service runs and has been running for 25, 30 years now.
So. And you're still at it after all these years.
I may be a creature of the dark or something. I like to come out at night. Yeah, there, and you know, I still don't know. They still puzzle me a lot, and so that's kind of fun. It's not like you get to know everything about them. They still have a lot of tricks up their sleeve. So it's tough studying an animal that just only out at night and lives most of its life underground. You just can't get, you can't spend a lot of time watching them, even if you wanted to. So
yeah. We are standing right now on an agate rock bed, which is on a prairie dog colony within this grasslands. So what we've got out here right now, we're just south of Badlands National Park. It's about 2 or 3 miles north of us. We can see that, but it's pretty flat right here where we are, and it's grassy with prairie dog mounds. Right now it's very calm. There's no wind tonight. We've got a beautiful full moon. It's pretty bright out here right now. We don't need our headlamps to even see. And you can actually even see prairie dog burrow mounds in the moonlight. They actually show up really nicely. Ferrets tend to be a bit more active in the full moon, and it probably is because they can see those burrow mounds even more readily than on a darker night.
Is that how they find their prey, visually?
No, actually, so prairie dogs right now are sleeping below ground, and a ferret is going to go out and kind of like connecting the dots, go from burrow to burrow. It's going to investigate. It's going to figure out which burrows contain prairie dogs. one of the common misconceptions is that there's a jillion prairie dogs out here and there's 10 prairie dogs in every burrow. Actually, very few of these burrows contain prairie dogs. So a prairie dog colony is consisting of what's called coteries, family units. Those are about an acre in size. Within that acre, you might have 50 to 100 prairie dog burrows, but you only got maybe 10 to 20 total prairie dogs in that whole area using those 50 to 100 burrows. Mm. So they're sleeping right now below ground, probably together in a family unit in a ball, because they're social. They're used to touching each other. They're used to being together. That's what prairie dogs are. They're colonial and social. So a ferret's going to connect the dots and run around. It's going to go down, investigate different burrows, figure out which one's got sleeping prairie dogs in it, creep down in that burrow, get down to where the chamber is where the prairie dogs are sleeping. Now, it's pitch black. It's a cave. So no matter how good your eyesight is, they can't see anything. They're going to use their tactile senses. They're going to use their whiskers and their feet, and they're going to kind of get down into the pile of prairie dogs, kind of do a little bit of Goldilocks. This one's too big. This one's too small. This one's just right. And clamp their mouth down on their neck and suffocate them. And so that's how they get a prairie dog.
And if there's other family members in there, is there a fight?
Sometimes the other ones wake up. Okay. Yes. And there's sometimes when we are trying to trap a ferret out of this burrow and you get a prairie dog in the trap because the ferret woke up the prairie dog family and they're getting out, they're getting away. Or you sometimes even find a prairie dog coming out of the burrow at night because a ferret is down there. Yeah. You know, not real often, but yeah.
There's no water around here.
Nothing.
The water comes from the grass.
Exactly.
Tell us a little bit about that. Why? Where is the ferret getting the water and where is the prairie dog getting the water?
So this western arid ecosystem is a very precious water balance. Yeah. We get about maybe 13 inches of rainfall annually. That's an average. I think we're probably below that for this year right now. Prairie dogs get all their metabolic water from grass. They don't drink standing water. There is no standing water. Parrots get all their metabolic water from prairie dogs. So when you've got dry years, you're going to have less grass production. You're going to have fewer prairie dogs. That's going to translate into sometimes fewer ferrets as well. Yeah. So this climate and this variability that we're seeing now of these really hot and wide swings of precipitation and heat and things like that is going to make that kind of a wider variability for prairie dogs and black-footed ferrets.
How was this season?
This season's dry. It is a dry year. We did not have a real good precipitation going into last winter, and so we think that right now we're seeing probably lower prairie dog production for 2025, and right now it's still early yet, but we think our ferret population is going to respond to that probably at a little lower level than last year. So I'm fortunate to have a lot of good partners that I work with, and Steve is certainly one of those, and I always enjoy bringing somebody with such gravitas in the program, and someone who is there, someone who's one of the reasons that we are here today, back out here, and that's just a gratifying thing, for, I think, for both of us. Yeah. I mean, if this is something that he and his colleagues kind of kicked off back in the 1980s, not knowing where it would go. You know, by the time you guys pulled those last 18 black-footed ferrets out of Meeteetse, there was no surety as to what was going to happen after that.
No, we hadn't. They hadn't been bred successfully in captivity at the time we pulled them out. That first effort that had happened a decade or so earlier, they never did get viable offspring out of that effort. So it was there's a lot of learning involved for the folks at the captive breeding end of it to figure out the lighting, the kind of diet, when the ferrets were ready to reproduce, and all of that had to be learned. There was no knowledge base that you could kick back on. So it took a couple years for that captive breeding effort to really kind of get in gear.
And was there documentation from the 20s or 30s or when there were more plentiful?
Well,
like, when did the population start collapsing, and who were the scientists historically who were tracking that and sounding the warning signs?
Yeah, if you can go back to the 20s and 30s, and there were biologists that warned essentially of the ultimate demise of predators like the ferret because of these very large-scale poisoning programs that were going on all over the West, including South Dakota.
Poisoning prairie dogs,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, the connection between ferrets and prairie dogs, they were pretty certain, yeah, this thing just seems to be only found on prairie dog colonies. That's the only observations we really have. And so there was, well, what happens when the prairie dogs are gone? What's going to happen to these guys? So there was a lot of thinking about that, but they just didn't have them. They didn't have the tools back then to, you know, you didn't have high intensity electric lights that you could drag out onto a prairie dog colony and look for them. So any observations they had were just kind of these anecdotal things during the daytime. You know, so it wasn't really till after World War II when we had a little bit better technology that you could actually go out at night and kind of look for them. Even by the time we found them in Metiti, very little was known, even though some had been brought into captivity. Just the life history, the physiology, the ecology, all of that was just scratched the surface at that time. And today we've got a much bigger, broader knowledge base about what we think they need, how big they ought to be in terms of their colony sizes and that kind of stuff. But back in those days, even in the early 1980s, we didn't even know necessarily how to breed them very well.
Again, this is detective work. These animals live below ground. They stay below ground for probably 20 to 22 hours a day, easily. Mm. And so we're trying to understand who's out there. Who are you? Where are you living? Are you vaccinated? Are you not vaccinated? Did you reproduce? Who's your mama? Who's your daddy? That's really what we're trying to do out here. And so as we talked about some of these other sites out there where you've got small populations, sometimes they go away and you just don't even know it because you can't find them anymore. So it's not like we find dead bodies. Yeah. We don't ever find dead bodies. We don't ever find dead ferrets. So when...
Because they're underground?
When they're underground. And so when things disappear, you've got to be on top of it. When Steve was working in Metiti in the 1980s, they counted 129 black-footed ferrets in 1984. And it took a lot of work to do that, a lot of spotlighting, a lot of they used ear tags on them to figure out, okay, what our population was. And they came back in the next year and found only 58 using the same methodology. So, but it took a lot of effort to get that data because, again, you've got these little creatures that live below ground that you can't just go out and just count them. It's not elk. You can't fly over with an airplane and go 1, 2, 3, 4. That's not the same way. So it takes a bit more detective work to pull all these different things together to find out what's really going on with these populations.
Yeah. So you're a patient man.
Well, I often wish they would just come clean and one of them would come up and lay out the whole story. No, we go over here and then we do this. And these burrows are all connected, so I just stay under here and eat out of this, you know, but it's not going to happen. So like Travis says, we've got to take the bits and pieces we get and try to piece together the story.
But the bottom line is that when things are going good, so last year we had a pretty good population size, they're easy to find. They're not that difficult to capture, really, you know, comparatively to some animals. You know, we were able to catch, again, 150 kits last year, plus some adults. That effort isn't something that is too Herculean to do. You just got to get out and do it. Get those spotlights out there, get those boots on the ground, and pound that ground. And if you see those green eyes shine, there they are.
Well, we're wasting moonlight.
Exactly.
Let's do it.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, it is a beautiful moonlit night in the Kanata Basin. Let's go find some black-footed ferrets. The first few critters we see aren't ferrets, but rather their predators. That includes an American badger we caught sight of on the way to the research trailer, and we have an encounter with the ferret's primary predator.
something up on the hill there, but that's not a ferret. Light shines way too big.
So it's a bigger animal?
Yep, you can even see kind of a body with it. But way too big, it's blinking. It's...
Do ferrets not blink?
Not in the way that you're going to see them at a distance, but you can see how big that eye shine is from this distance. That's, you can see a body now, it's a coyote.
Travis tries to entice it closer. He has a message for this coyote.
Hey, leave my ferrets alone. Yeah, you heard me.
Noted.
We saw another coyote during the night and a second badger, as well as a few burrowing owls. And every few minutes, it seemed, we startled some horned larks from their ground nests. They fluttered up in front of the windshield and flew off into the dark night. But we're here for the black-footed ferrets.
Another ferret up there.
This is the first sighting of a particular ferret we came to refer to as the Traveler. He's a bold little guy.
Like peekaboo.
Yep. Exactly. Pop goes the weasel.
Patient observation revealed a blue stripe of dye already on his neck, meaning this ferret has been counted and vaccinated for the season.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That blue stripe across. Yep.
Oh, my.
Definitely blue. Okay. So we don't need to capture this animal. You can just watch it and let it be. That's a kit that was that my other guys caught here a couple nights ago.
They have a very interesting way of moving.
They're bounders. Yeah, they don't walk like a normal quadruped, like a dog or something like that. Have that gait. They've got a bounding gait where the back feet land where their front feet were.
Their necks are longer than I thought they'd be.
Yeah, they're just. Take a mammal and just stretch it out.
That thing is probably half neck.
Yeah. All right, we're going to go right up to where he was. I'm just going to get a GPS location and mark it that we saw a ferret. He had a blue line on him, and we don't need to capture him, but we observed him.
With that, we say goodbye to the Traveler, but it won't be the last time we see him this night.
Hey. Just be careful, buddy.
Look at him go.
Oh. When we find a non-marked ferret, we drive up to its burrow. Laveri pulls a long wire cage wrapped in canvas out of the pickup bed. He eases the end of the trap into the burrow's entrance and packs dirt lightly around the opening. And later, when we return,
well, hello there. We have a ferret.
He brings the cage and ferret back to the cab of the truck for a workup.
The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to check for a microchip. Here's my reader. Turn it on, get it ready. You are 23-099, a male. You have all of your shots because I have released down here. So you can be let go. But we're going to put some dye mark on you so that if we see you again tonight, know that you've already been captured and we don't even do anything. So take one. Hair dye markers.
the other side of your neck. Thank you for being so cooperative. Okay, let's let him go.
We bring the cage and black-footed ferret back to the original burrow. Laveri allows us to keep our microphone within a few inches of the endangered animal.
So I'm going to lay the trap on the ground right here. Yep. Come out this way. So let's see. You can probably get it right up here. Okay, bud.
The ferret is facing the closed end of the cage and doesn't seem to realize there is freedom right behind him. Laveri coaxes the ferret out of the trap by rustling a plastic bag along the sides of the wire cage. The ferret scurries on home, and we return to the truck.
Wow. So that was one of less than 500 animals in the world, in the wild. That was one right there.
The story of the black-footed ferret is one of hills and valleys. They used to skitter, dash, hunt, and bound across these grasslands back when prairie dog colonies stretched as far as the eye could see. They followed their main food source. They made homes in abandoned prairie dog burrows. Then came the poisoning campaigns. Poisoning the prairie dog meant humans were also poisoning the black-footed ferret. As you heard earlier, the black-footed ferret was declared extinct in 1979. And then a dog in Wyoming named Shep found one at his food bowl. Then came years of hard-earned scientific success, but then another population-wide disaster, the plague. Yes, that one started infecting prairie dogs, which meant it also infected and killed black-footed ferrets. Biologists like Steve Forrest and Travis Laveri launched a large-scale effort to save the ferrets from the epidemic. The species was pulled back from the brink once again through vaccination and large-scale insecticide dusting of burrows. And you may remember from history class, the plague spreads through fleas.
The day in 2008 when we got the word that plague had entered this ecosystem. One of the reasons that this population has been so successful is plague was never in this ecosystem. And then in 2008, it invaded for the first time ever. So that was a hard day. That was May of 2008. And then last year in 2024, it returned. And I remember getting the phone call. My heart was racing. And I had to sit down and take a deep breath and kind of, okay, what do we do now? 2024 was a hard year of battling plague, and a lot of people involved in that, and a lot of resources poured into it, and we were fortunate that we pulled together a pretty substantial effort across many agencies and organizations, a lot of just dedicated people, and we were able to preserve this population. And again, we had 246 black-footed ferrets last year, despite plague entering this ecosystem again.
So then is there an end date to that? Is over the winter, does it go away? How does that work? Or is it once it's here all the time? Help me understand that.
Yeah, plague is by far our largest biological impediment to recovery of black-footed ferrets, and there's a lot we don't understand about plague in prairie dog ecosystems. It invaded here for the first time in 2008, and from 2008 through about 2015, the population of ferrets and prairie dogs slowly declined, or first drastically, and then slowly declined through that period, and then we came out of it and it increased again. We got all the way down to 50 black-footed ferrets in 2013. From a high of 355
in 2007. So in a 5-6 year period, we lost a massive amount of the ferret population, despite the fact that we were battling plague with insecticide, dust, and vaccines. So had we not done that, we would have lost the whole ferret population. There's no doubt in my mind. So our ferret population and our prairie dog population started to rebound after 2015, and we kept kind of looking for plague. Sometimes the best way to look for plague is looking at coyotes and badgers if they've been exposed to it. And so we were looking at the serology of different carnivores around here. We weren't seeing any evidence of plague. We weren't sure, did it go away? Is it still here? We don't really know. The ecology of plague is really hard to understand and study. It's not something that's just easily measured. And so we were kind of crossing our fingers, maybe it's gone. You know, we've gone through 8 years of continued growth of prairie dogs and ferret population. And then in 2024, it returned. And it likely had reemerged. It's probably been sitting in the background here at some level throughout that time and just reemerged at multiple points. So that told us plague may be here to stay. And we're probably going to have to deal with plague at some level going into the future.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're spending this hour rumbling along the Kanata Basin with black-footed ferret biologist Travis Leveri. Drought in the national grasslands this year has most likely caused a drop in new births in the world's most robust black-footed ferret population. Biologists are still counting the season's new kits. At around 250 known black-footed ferrets here at home, we're talking about a shockingly vulnerable endangered species. But this night, we have seen black-footed ferrets bounding amongst the fetid marigold, scampering into prairie dog burrows, periscoping their slender necks, and flashing their emerald eye shine in the direction of our spotlight. At times, it seemed they were almost posing for us.
Last time I talked to you, we talked about your relationship with hope, and you said, you know, you get to hold hope in your hand. And I'm wondering, you know, this is a positive story and it's a tenuous, fragile story. After going through a year like 2024, what's your relationship with hope right now?
It's still there. It's right there in those green eyes. It's the fact that had we not put that tremendous effort forward last year, those green eyes might not be there. So again, it's present for me. I get to have that hope right in my hands still, and I'm hopeful because I think there are some folks in the younger generation that even though they're so involved with phones and TikTok and media and whatnot, that some of them are getting out and using our public lands. There's a lot of folks visiting the national parks and public lands these days. Almost, dare I say, too many.
If the black-footed ferret population is fragile, then so is what we are doing here tonight. How much attention should we bring to the plight of the continent's most endangered mammal?
You know, if it goes viral, you know, here's almost a nightmare scenario. It goes viral, and then I've got tourists that line up on Kanata Road at night that want to watch me go find black-footed ferrets. Right. You know, they don't want to, you know.
A negative outcome.
Yeah. Right, exactly, right. Yeah. You know, or they want to get pictures of them, and they're getting mad at me because I'm putting blue splotches across the necks.
Yeah, right.
That ruins their photo.
Well, I think it gets to this point of, you know, what is the call to action here, you know? So I guess if someone was listening to this, what do you want them to do?
Get involved in your public lands management. We are driving around on U.S. Forest Service land. You own this land. Everyone owns this land. and you have a say in how your land is managed, your public lands. So make sure that your voice is being heard for your public lands management. And I know that's not easy. It's one thing to say, call up and tell the Forest Service district ranger that you like black-footed ferrets and you want them to, you know, be managed for here. That doesn't immediately translate into anything. It's, you know, can you call up Dusty Johnson or John Thune and Mike Rollins? Maybe, you know. But when there's federal actions that are being taken for grazing management or something like that, or some other action being taken that's published in the Federal Register, you know, and sometimes it's a NEPA document, National Environmental Policy Act, where they're having to analyze the effects of some proposed action. And that's sometimes where the voices are best. Those are not easy things to figure out and do. So sometimes relying upon organizations like Defenders of Wildlife or World Wildlife Fund or others that can put out those alerts, be on their email list. Even if you aren't going to donate to them, be on their email list. But I would say also donate to them as well, because they are actively involved in on-the-ground conservation with black-footed ferrets too. That's probably the best way. And that's not an easy thing to just to say. Take this all with a grain of salt that I'm a stinky ferret biologist. That's what I do best. I am not an educator. I'm not a policymaker. What we are doing right now is the thing I am best suited to do for black-footed ferret conservation. So I don't know what the best way to educate folks is. I hope there's others that can guide this effort in a better way so I can keep doing what I do best and they can do what they do best, and we can do that together for the benefit of black-footed ferrets.
Pink and lavender light has begun to tint the eastern sky, the early hints of sunrise over the national grasslands. This conservation project has made national and even international news. Black-footed ferrets are, in a word, relatable.
You do look at a picture of them, they've got this curious, almost somewhat innocent look with that black bandit mask on them. And you see those little black feet when they are out running around, and that slinky of a body. And you look at it and you say to yourself, that's our native ferret. That belongs here. That's what was always here. How could we not want more of those in North America? How can we not want to help these guys exist and thrive, our native ferret species?
Travis Leveri's job is often solitary, but after 8 hours in the truck with two reporters, he has covered everything from the history of the band Van Halen to how his work was once plagiarized by a romance author to his professional friendship with famed wildlife biologist Dr. Jane Goodall. Our throats are now coated with dust. The conversation begins to wander. Plus, it's time to say goodnight to our nocturnal companions.
Yeah, let's see if this is our traveling one that's just making a round, or is this somebody? Can you show me your neck? Yeah, you are the traveler, okay. You need to be careful there, buddy.
That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. For Ellen Kester and all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.